Second case for argument this morning is United States against Yu Xian Lei.
May it please the court.
Wait for the change to be completed here. Mr. Ma.
Yeah. Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Judge Rovner over there.
Thank you.
My name is Peng Qian Ma for the defendant in this case. My client was charged and convicted of the crime of harboring illegal aliens. This conviction should be reversed for several reasons. First of all, my client did not entertain the intent to commit the crime charged. Secondly, my client did not receive a fair trial. And as to the issue of the intent, the jury instructions issued to the jurors were defective and did not specify to the jurors that in order to convict my client, not only the government had to prove that the defendant had not...
Wasn't the instruction question based almost verbatim on an instruction submitted by your client's counsel?
Your Honor, the record is not clear who proposed the instructions, but we request this court to
hear about the instructions that the defendant proposed. Seems to me there's a copy of the defendant's proposals in the record.
I have it right here. Defendant's proposed instruction number 16.
What's the lack of clarity?
Yeah, Your Honor, we ask this court to review this error under the plain error standard. If it is plainly...
No, what is the lack of clarity? You said the record was not clear about what instructions the defendant proposed. What's the problem?
The record was not complete when we first wrote the brief, and later on the government enlarged the record. We did not know what part was missing until November 18th when we were busy with the reply brief.
Well, now you know the defense submitted that instruction, and so you can't talk about plain error. You would have waived error by submitting the very instruction about which you complain.
We addressed this issue in our brief. It's not a waived error. It's a forfeited error because our position is that the error is plain. The error affected the substantial right of our client. The court did not instruct.
If the district judge gives an instruction that the defendant proposed, why is that not waiver?
But it is wrong. If it was plainly wrong, we should not stop here.
There is a distinction between forfeiture and waiver. I'm asking, if the judge gives the defendant's proposed instruction, why is that not waiver?
It was a plain error that even if nobody proposed anything, Your Honor, you have to notice our brief. We also argued that the counsel represented my client at the trial provided ineffective assistance.
Well, that raises another point. Do you really want to make that argument here? Does your client want you to make that argument? It's my question, because if he does, it's decided solely on the record that we have. It cannot be supplemented as it could be on a 2255 post-conviction where you could have a more full record. Does your client want to pursue that argument?
We addressed that issue in our brief. Actually, I did not plan to make our argument on that issue today.
Have you informed your client that if we reject this ineffective assistance argument, he will not ever be able to raise it on collateral review?
In other words, what the judges are trying to say to you, Mr. Ma, is that you can withdraw that argument at this time, and discuss it with your client.
Your Honor, I have discussed with my client regarding the assistance, the quality of representation at the trial level. We are not withdrawing that argument at this time.
Well, you need to understand, I think your client needs to understand, the Seventh Circuit was established in 1891 and has now been around for 118 years. And during that time, the number of ineffective assistance arguments on direct appeal that have succeeded is zero. Zero in 118 years. And the reason why they never succeed is because without having a supplemental proceeding to enlarge the record and discover why the trial lawyer proceeded as he did, it's impossible for the defendant to discharge the burdens laid on him by Strickland against Washington. Now, one of the things that you should be discussing with your client is whether he wants to take the chance that he will be the first, or instead to reserve the opportunity to raise this argument on collateral review.
Since, Your Honor, you give me that piece, I deem that also that's a piece of comments. I will reserve the opportunity to attack to raise the issue later on if we have that opportunity.
No later on opportunity to raise it. You have raised it. The question that the judges are asking is whether your client really wants to pursue it. We're giving you an opportunity to withdraw the argument before it does your client any damage.
You want me to consult with my client right now?
Not right now, but we suggest that you do so, and we will give you 10 days after argument to inform us whether you wish to withdraw this contention.
Of course. The intent issue involves two sub-issues. The first one is the jury instructions defective. Secondly, in the record, there is no evidence showing that my client intended to commit the crime charged.
You know, Mr. Ma, does it really matter in this case if the standard is specific intent? In other words, I could see the argument in a case where an illegal immigrant was hiding in Mr. Lee's basement. You know, Mr. Lee never went to the basement. But that's certainly not the fact scenario before us. Once the jury convicted on these facts, it is implausible that the jury could have thought that he committed this crime without a specific intent. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, Your Honor. Because the judge was not properly instructed, the focus of the discussion, the focus of the instructions was on the knowledge of my client of the status of the aliens. The jury confused the intent requirement with the knowledge requirement, because this is a peculiar case where the jury has to be instructed as to the knowledge or reckless disregard of the status of the aliens. And on the other hand, the issue of intent is also involved, because the court did not specifically instruct the jury as to the separate two issues. The jury was confused. The jury thought that once it is established that my client had knowledge of the illegal status of the aliens, or he recklessly disregarded the illegal status of the aliens, he hired them, they assumed that the intent issue, the intent element was established. That's the reason of our appeal. And secondly, my client did not receive a fair trial. The major evidence was through the taped deposition of the two harbored aliens, the two alleged harbored aliens. The jury was shown only the videotapes.
Again, didn't your client's attorney request that procedure as opposed to live testimony?
He did not request it. That's, I think he agreed to the, he gave his consent to the procedure. But because it was in the form of a deposition, the trial counsel raised objections to the testimony of the during the deposition. But the judge was not there. Nobody was making a ruling as to the objections. The tapes were shown to the jury, and also The surprisingly, the most prejudicial part of the tape was that at least one tape was not complete. My client noticed the incompleteness of the tape and stood up and said that the tape is not complete. And what was done, that's the, I counted the transcript. The transcript of the deposition was read to the jury. But I counted the transcript. 8 pages of the deposition was read to the jury through the judge. The judge played the role of the witness. The judge read the answers. Counsels read the questions. That's amazing. That's amazingly that the judge was not aware. That's very, very prejudicial, because the testimony, the remarks, the statements from the witness was conveyed to the jury through the mouth of the judge. That's cannot be more plain. That's an error. And I will go back to the jury instructions issue. I tried to uncover some cases regarding a balanced structure of jury instructions. I did not find any Seventh Circuit case, but I did find 2 cases. One is from the Fifth Circuit. That case is Perez versus the United States. The citation is 297 F. 2nd, 12. That's a 1961 case. This case is for the proposition, although the jury instruction might have mentioned everything required, but the jury instructions should not overemphasize one portion of the of a particular matter. Should not lay stress on particular matters. The instruction should be balanced. Another case is a state case. It's our state's case. The name of the case is Ryan versus Monson, M-O-N-S-O-N. It's also a 1961 case. It says the jury instructions should not the court should not give instructions which lay undue stress upon particular matters. In this case, the jury instructions overemphasized the knowledge portion of the case. That is only one element. The jury instructions de-emphasized the specific intent portion of the case. And for the conviction, that should be for the 2 reasons, the conviction should be reversed. We also raised the issue of the forfeiture of the house. Since I still have time, I'll argue that issue as well. The record shows that my client is a restaurant owner. He did not only provide employment to his workers. He also provided housing for the workers.
And laundry opportunities in the basement.
But my client still lives there. My client, his family lived in the house.
Wasn't he facing about $500,000 in potential fines on these charges?
Yeah, Your Honor, our position is that whether the fine is unconstitutionally excessive should depend on a lot of factors. In this case, the defendant's family resided in the same house, and some employees prefer to live in the basement. Some employees prefer to live on the first floor, but all together with the family. There was no mortgage on the house. If the house is confiscated, where?
Well, I don't understand this line of argument. As Judge Tinder said, the statutes allow a fine of $250,000 a count, or $500,000 total. If the judge had fined your client $200,000, and the only way to pay the fine was to sell the house, It would have all been the same outcome.
Yeah, that is constantly the same. That's constitutionally excessive.
So your objection is that a fine of $180,000, because there was an express $10,000 monetary fine here, is excessive. Has any court ever held that a fine of $180,000 is excessive for any crime?
It depends on the particular facts of the case.
No, I'm asking whether any court has ever held this in any case, under any facts.
I did not uncover any case with specific dollar amounts, but I believe that whether the fine is proper should be considered based on the facts of each particular case.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Okay. Do I still have time for rebuttal?
No, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Koenig.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is
counsel. John. Counsel, please sit at counsel table. Mr. Cohn.
I represent the United States in this appeal, and I was trial counsel below. Before briefly addressing the mens rea issue, I would like to clarify some factual points. The first goes, I guess, to the equities of the forfeiture issue, to the extent the equities are in play at all.
I don't think there's anything here about equity. The claim is that the forfeiture violates the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. That's not some general equity doctrine.
I completely agree, Your Honor.
My
opponent has repeatedly asserted that his children live in this house, which compounds the unfairness, I guess, in his view, of the forfeiture. That's belied by the record. I would refer Your Honors to paragraph 58 of the pre-sentence report. I would also like to clarify the procedure.
I don't comprehend how that has anything to do with the Eighth Amendment.
Well, it was raised by my opponent, and I just wanted to clarify the facts, Your Honor. I agree with you. It has nothing to do with the Eighth Amendment.
Could I just ask you something? The trial judge read the witnesses part of the deposition transcript when some of the video portions became unavailable. Wasn't that extremely prejudicial, as Mr. Ma argued?
I would argue no, Your Honor, for two reasons. First of all, we're talking about the tail end of Mr. Wang's deposition, so that the jury did have an ample opportunity to assess his demeanor and credibility throughout the portion of the tape that was not problematic. And there was no objection. So however that issue relates to the issues that are in my opponent's brief, which isn't clear, the issue is waived. It hasn't been explained. In other words, how the substance of it would be prejudicial.
Well, I mean, it's like vouching, isn't it? I mean, the judge?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the jury was well aware of what was going on. We had a technical problem in the courtroom. As I recall, there was a sidebar during which I offered perhaps we could take a recess and try to address the issue. The judge was the one who proposed this mechanism. And as I say, there was no objection. Later on, the issue was raised again, but at the time, there was no objection to proceeding in that fashion.
Was Mr. Ma's characterization of it being 8 pages accurate?
I think so. I want to say the deposition was maybe 30 minutes or 45 minutes, and we were talking about the last 10.
And that's one of the three videotaped witnesses, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
What did the 8 pages constitute out of that total deposition?
Oh, gosh, I'd be guessing 40 pages, maybe?
Okay.
I'm sorry. I don't have them in front of me at the moment. But while we're on the subject of the depositions, I also would like to clarify the procedure that was used. We deposed the material witnesses under Rule 16, videotaped the depositions with translators present and, of course, the defendant as well, and his counsel. Counsel had an opportunity to object. Judge Griesbach then offered an opportunity for pretrial motions directed at those objections. In other words, counsel wanted to persist in an objection, he was able to raise that in a motion in limine. We had a telephonic conference during which the judge identified portions of the transcripts that would not be read to the jury. Those portions were edited out, and I just want the court to be very clear about that, because in parts of my opponent's brief, he makes it sound like everything came in, and then he talks about Mr. Wang, the end of Mr. Wang's deposition, not enough came in. And so I just wanted to lay out what the procedure was that the judge used in the case.
You know, just if we could move on, Mr. Ma claimed that a general intent crime that's based on knowledge alone would implicate a whole range of people who interact with illegal aliens and provide them aid. And I wondered how you would respond, because, you know, we all know that there are churches and shelters that provide shelter to the homeless, among whom a large proportion are known to be illegal immigrants.
Your Honor, you raise an interesting policy question, and I'm not aware of any cases, certainly in our district, where we have prosecuted cases like that. This was a commercial context, a financial crime, squarely within, I believe, the intent of Congress in passing this statute. And I would add that in order to agree with the defendant on this particular issue, the court would have to jump through at least three hoops that I can identify. First, it would have to disregard its precedent on waiver as it relates to jury instructions. Here we have even more than we had in Griffin. We had the defendant proposing the instruction that was given. The court would then have to agree that this is a specific intent crime, and then it would have to find that the evidence was insufficient to support the crime, such that the fairness and integrity of the proceeding would be called into question under a plain error analysis. And as your question seemed to suggest, Judge Rovner, earlier, that might matter in a case where the evidence was thin, but this is not that case. There was ample evidence of the defendant's state of mind. It was circumstantial, true enough, but that's very often the case. I really have very little to add to my brief at this point, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that the panel has. Obviously, we would like you to affirm the conviction and the judgment, including the restitution order.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.